You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the NRA drew criticism from doctors this weekend after it told them to, quote, stay in their lane, end quote, when it came to conversations about gun control. We'll talk about the debate over guns and who gets a say in that battle. First, it was 20 years ago this month that human embryonic stem cells were first derived in a laboratory setting. The breakthrough made at UW-Madison by researcher James Thompson and his team was huge news even beyond scientific circles. In the two decades that followed, despite some political controversy, scientists in Wisconsin and beyond have produced more discoveries using stem cells and transformed the field of medical and biological research. Timothy Camp is a professor of medicine and the director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center at UW-Madison. He's in the studio now. Tim, thanks a lot for being here.
My pleasure.
Well, before we get back to this discovery 20 years ago, talk about what makes these embryonic stem cells so special when it comes to medical and biological research.
Well, these cells are human cells, so that's the starting point, and they are master stem cells that can grow indefinitely in culture. We call that self-renew, so you can have unlimited amounts. And then what really is the power is that then, under the right conditions, you can form any cell type present in the body. So we're interested in heart muscle. We can make heart muscle cells or brain cells or pancreatic islet cells or kidney cells, all from this master stem cell. So it really gives you access to human cells in the laboratory and potentially for therapy.
We'll talk more about what we can do with those cells, but now take us back to James Thompson and his lab in 1998. As I understand it, he wasn't the only scientist in the world trying to do what he did. What was he able to do ultimately that other researchers around the world weren't?
Well, just for background, embryonic stem cells were first isolated successfully from the mouse, and that happened in about 1981, and there were two papers that showed that that was possible in the mouse, and so the thought was at the time, a lot of excitement that we'd be able to get those cells, and by we I mean the scientific community, from any species easily after we discovered how to do it for the mouse. Turned out it wasn't that easy, and that there are many animals and species that we haven't been able to get embryonic stem cells from. And obviously, there was a lot of interest in making them from human tissue, and that started back in the early 1980s. But it really, people didn't have success with it, and it took Dr. Thompson and his efforts really with monkeys to first derive embryonic stem cells from monkeys, which was published in 1995, to really understand how to grow stem cells from non-human primates. And that enabled him to then jump forward and using surplus in vitro fertilization embryos or embryos that were made for fertility problems by couples who couldn't use them for their fertility problems because they'd already had children, for example, and were going to discard them or freeze them. They were donated for research. And from those, Jamie was able to take out the special inner cell mast cells and grow them as embryonic stem cells. So it was a lot of interest in making them, but really the breakthrough was here that developed the conditions and the ability to grow those cells.
The source of the cells led to some ethical concerns and political disagreements about things like federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. Can you talk about some of the issues that came out even in the early days?
Well, I think the issues remain, and the issue is that the source of the cells is the surplus in vitro fertilization embryo, and those embryos, to some people, represent the same thing as human life, you and I speaking now. And obviously, if that is your belief, then that procedure to get those embryonic stem cells back then destroyed the embryo and has created ethical challenges. For other people, seeing sort of a cluster of nondescript cells that haven't specialized at all in a dish seem very different than fully mature person or fetus. And so many people thought that it was ethically permissible to use these cells, which otherwise were going to be discarded. But that's the sort of the crux of the concern, your definition of human life. And I'm not sure we're going to solve that in the next few minutes. But because that's such a challenging ethical question, obviously public policy has to address it. And because there was differences in public policy, and because research using fetal tissue is officially forbidden from government-funded research, and so that meant Jamie's original derivation was done without federal dollars, without the government support, so he had to get private dollars and do it in a place that didn't have any federal funding. And then the issue was, how could you use those cells, because federal funding wouldn't support that. And it created a conundrum in the research community that ultimately led to 2001, when the Bush administration came up with a compromise on how to use these cells, which were seen as extremely promising for scientific applications and potentially therapy, but obviously a bit of a political hot potato. And so the compromise, with the help of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, our former governor at the time, Tommy Thompson, was that all the human embryonic stem cell derived lines that were available as of August 8, 2001, were okay for research. But anything after that, no federal funds would go to. So that was sort of the compromise we lived with back then.
We're talking to Timothy Camp, director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center at UW-Madison. It was 20 years ago this month that a UW researcher, UW-Madison researcher James Thompson, made a breakthrough in embryonic human stem cells. So what happened next in terms of research? What were we able to start doing after this discovery by James Thompson?
Well, I think what the discovery did is it opened up a variety of different investigations, not only here at the University of Wisconsin, but around the world. There was no doubt that these cells were important tools for many, many different laboratories. And part of the remarkable thing is how Jamie was able to get these cells in high quality and be able to share them with researchers around the world to allow them to start to do their research, which could involve making the cells turn into neurons, for example, heart cells, trying to get various cells, for example, motor neurons that may be important in understanding diseases like paralysis of various forms, islet cells for diabetes. And so researchers started taking these cells and making them into the specialized cell types and then doing research with those cell types in the dish first to try and understand how well the stem cell-derived cells mimic the real thing, and also to use them as a tool to understand human biology. And by that, what I mean is that it's hard to get, for example, human heart cells for research applications. You know, it's one thing to get a skin biopsy, but most patients, it's hard to get a piece of their heart to study in a dish. And the research that we need to do oftentimes needs living heart cells. And so it gave us a way to have living heart cells to study in a dish that we could, for example, test drugs to see how they affected human heart cells in a dish, knowing that it was the behavior of a human heart cell, that we could then also look for toxic effects, too, from compounds.
Now, one amazing part of the discovery isn't just that, okay, we've isolated these embryonic human stem cells, but if I have this right, we can coach them. We can coach them into becoming the heart cell or stem cell or a nerve cell, I guess, whatever we want it to be.
Yes, yes. Coaching is a good description. If you like scientific words, we call it differentiate.
Okay.
But convince, persuade, whatever you want to say. But with the right conditions, you can get them to go to the specific lineages. And that took some time to get better and better at that. Laboratories weren't very efficient at that. But over time, just like anything else, it continues to get better and better, and we can get more pure and more functional populations of these cells.
The hope, in addition to being used for research, which has obvious benefits, the hope, I know 20 years ago, was that this would lead to therapies as well. Can you talk about some of, and this is something that isn't going to happen overnight, but can you talk about some of the quest for using stem cells for therapeutic purposes?
Well, I think from the initial discovery, it was recognized that these cells would have possibilities for therapies, and perhaps recognized too well, with a lot of excitement, a lot of anticipation. And And like all new avenues of therapy, especially something as radically new as an embryonic stem cell, it takes a while to work through the process of developing a cellular product to be a safe product and to be shown to be effective in animal models before you can put it in people. To give you an example, a small molecule, something that you can know down to the molecular structure, a single molecule, a drug, you know, from concept to getting it into patients at minimum is 10 to 15 years and quite costly, $1 billion or more nowadays. So you think of a cell and the complexities of a cell with the, you know, hundreds of thousands of different protein isoforms and DNA and so forth, and getting that in a controlled space that you can reproducibly produce and use safely for therapy is no secret. It's a challenge. And so I think there was a little unrealistic anticipation that some of these therapies would be coming down the pipeline. You know, you would hear it in a few years, 5 years, but, you know, they're just now starting to hit the road. And so what we're seeing now is after 20 years, you're starting to see some of the first clinical trials with the human embryonic stem cells. The first one actually was in 2010, and that was a trial led by the Geron company to look at spinal cord injury with a particular supportive cell for the neurons of the spinal cord called oligodendrocytes. And so that was sort of the first one in 2010, but there have been several more initiated now.
We're talking to Tim Camp right now, director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center at UW-Madison, looking at 20 years of stem cell research that started at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about research and what's been accomplished using stem cells? Are you curious about what's possible, what probably isn't? Have you, on the political and ethical side, has your opinion about stem cell research changed over time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Tim Camp, director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center at UW-Madison, looking at 20 years of stem cell research in Wisconsin and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about stem cells, the history of the research surrounding them, what they can and can't do, what the future might hold? Call in at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Tim, I want to turn to more recent developments in stem cells. I want to make sure I have this right. We've been talking about taking embryonic human stem cells and turning them into other kinds of cells. Do I have this right? We've figured out I'm not taking any credit for it, how to take some adult cells, developed cells, and flip them back into these precursor cells, these undeveloped cells?
That's a great point, Rob, and that is what's called induced pluripotent stem cells. So one of the things that the embryonic stem cells taught us are what are the gene regulatory networks, the things in the control center of your cells that control what genes are turned on and off, and a list of factors was derived from embryonic stem cells, and what investigators, including Jamie Thompson and Shinya Yamanaka in Japan, did is they took those factors and expressed them in skin cells or blood cells, and were able to reprogram those to a state that's very much like embryonic stem cells by also taking advantage of the special culture conditions to grow embryonic stem cells. So we've sort of been able to flip development upside down and take the cells back in time, so we can take a cell from you or me or anyone for that matter and reprogram it back to a master stem cell called an induced pluripotent stem cell that really behaves very much like an embryonic stem cell in that it can grow indefinitely in culture and it can form any cell type in the body.
Is that going to be therapeutically useful? Because it seems like, if I have this right, that thing you flipped back to that pluripotent stem cell, it's still going to have my DNA. Is this something that my body's going to recognize as me, even though it's a different kind of me than it was when it came out?
Well, that's one of the hopes with induced pluripotent stem cells, that they potentially can provide patient-specific therapies. Because one of our challenges, if we don't use your cells on you, is that the immune system can recognize them as foreign and reject them. And so that's the challenge we have when we do solid organ transplantation, like heart transplant or kidney transplant. We have to give immunosuppressives so those donor organs aren't rejected by the recipient because they're not perfectly matched. With your own iPS cells, potentially they'll be perfectly matched with you and you wouldn't need immunosuppression.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Tammy is with us in Sun Prairie. Tammy, hi.
Hi.
What question did you want to bring up, Tammy?
Well, I think you maybe somewhat just answered it, but I always have wondered why. I understand that embryonic stem cells were the ones that the original lines are derived from, but I always wondered why umbilical cord stem cells couldn't be used, which would negate the whole question, you know, of where does life begin, human life begin kind of question. So I always wondered what the holdback was for using the umbilical cord stem cell.
So umbilical cord stem cells do have applications, and they are used, for example, in bone marrow transplantation. The difference is that they're not master stem cells. They're not pluripotent stem cells, so they can't form all the different cell types present in the body. They're good at making certain cells, particularly of the blood lineage, but they can't form heart cells or brain cells, so they're not the pluripotent or master stem cells.
Interesting. Tammy, thanks a lot for that question. We'll go next to Christopher in Stevens Point. Christopher, hello.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Christopher?
I was wondering if they came out with anything better than stem cells or anything else that's promising for heart disease and stuff.
That's a great question. There's always ongoing research to look at new therapies for heart disease. And I would say there are many things in the works. I was just at the American Heart Association meeting in Chicago this weekend, and many promising therapies. But, it's hard to benchmark against really the untested stem cells for the heart. We really haven't put them to the big test where we can get these pluripotent stem cells in and see what they can do yet. So I think there are other therapies for many forms of heart disease that are promising, but the hope with stem cells is they'll really be a game changer and a major step forward, but we don't know that yet.
Christopher, thanks for that call. We're talking to Tim Camp from UW-Madison, looking at 20 years of research in embryonic stem cells, how they're being used in research and therapy. Tim, there's a lot of news out there, of course, in the human genome, using CRISPR to edit genes. Is there an overlap? Are we using CRISPR on stem cells?
Well, I would say there is overlap because the human pluripotent stem cells, for example, induced pluripotent stem cells with a patient from a patient that has a genetic disease potentially can be genome edited with CRISPR-Cas9, the new method to specifically go in and change just a part of the genome that's defective and correct it potentially, is being tested in the laboratory. And there are some hopes that taking stem cells and differentiating them, making the special cell types that are corrected, may be able to treat some diseases. So there certainly is overlap and a lot of interest in using gene editing in stem cells.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the hopes for quick therapies may have exceeded, the pace at which we develop therapies. There are clinics out there around the world that advertise themselves as offering stem cell treatment. We should approach those skeptically, as I understand it.
This is a challenging area for the public because it's difficult oftentimes to tell the genuine sort of scientifically robust clinics using stem cells and the ones that maybe aren't. And at this stage, there really aren't, for most applications, well-proven stem cell therapies. Most of the clinical applications are still in what are called clinical trials. And so they're being tested in patients to see if they're effective or not. And until they're really proven effective and safe, it's hard to know what to expect for them. And unfortunately, there are many clinics, estimated up to 2,000 in the United States right now, that are giving stem cells for unproven applications. And that's really the challenge. And oftentimes those are recognized by the price tag associated with those therapies because insurance companies are only going to support proven therapies. And these unproven therapies, it's out-of-pocket expense. So if you're looking at a big out-of-pocket expense, think twice.
Let's take one more caller before we run out of time. Chad is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Chad, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering, of those therapies, how's it looking for disc regeneration in backs for herniated bulging discs? I know there's a lot of companies doing that right now. Maybe that's some of the ones that are unproven.
What's the state of research on that?
Well, first a disclosure. I'm a cardiologist, not an orthopedic doctor, so I can't be too definitive. Right now, there aren't stem cell therapies proven for degenerative disc disease. However, there's a lot of biomechanical engineering approaches, matrices, in other words, special substances to put in there to help the disc heal itself up, that I'm certain there's a variety of applications and progress on that. But not so much on the stem cell avenue that I'm aware of.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. Looking forward, what are some of the frontiers that have you the most excited, whether within your own field of research or with stem cells more generally?
Well, I think what you're seeing right now is the transition of a lot of this stem cell technology from the research laboratory to industry and companies. And that's important. It's just like drug development. If you really want to mass produce and have effective therapies that are safe and are done in a manufacturing process that you know is reproducible, that's hard to do in my lab or any academic lab, but companies, you know, design facilities, very high-tech facilities to do this. So I think we're going to start to see a lot of this move forward in a way that it does have applications in patients that are meaningful and more broadly available. So that's exciting. And I think you already touched on the gene editing as a very exciting area that will help us improve our cell therapies.
We'll leave it there. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Timothy Camp, professor of medicine and director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center at UW-Madison. He's with us to look at the past 20 years of stem cell research here in Wisconsin and what the future might hold. Coming up, we'll talk about the NRA, gun control, doctors, and who gets to have a say in the gun debate. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on the morning show, find out what last week's election results could mean for environmental policy here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the National Rifle Association got a lot of backlash from doctors this weekend after the organization told physicians via Twitter to, quote, stay in their lane, end quote, when it came to gun control. Emergency room doctors responded with graphic images and stories of treating gunshot wounds, and said that guns and gun violence fall under their area of expertise. Mike Spees covers the gun lobby for The Trace. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We'll talk a little bit more. Give us an overview of what happened online this weekend in the gun debate.
A new study came out I'm actually forgetting which medical journal it was in exactly.
The Annals of Internal Medicine, I think it was.
Right. And it was not a flattering portrayal for the NRA, as is often the case when it comes to medical studies that have to do with gunshot victims. And the NRA's response was to send out an incendiary tweet, I think 24 hours after the last mass shooting, saying, or essentially telling doctors to stay in their own lane, and essentially also saying that they didn't know what they were talking about, and suggesting they were biased and not consulted what they feel to be the appropriate people to speak on such matters, which, according to the NRA, is the NRA.
And then we saw a big response from doctors around the country, a lot of doctors talking about their experiences dealing with gunshot wounds and fatalities. Now, this isn't
right. A
new issue between doctors and the NRA. You've covered on and off a story going on in Florida about a law that restricted what doctors could ask their patients about. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. There is an ongoing feud between the National Rifle Association and the medical community, and it has played out in a couple different ways. One of the most notable ways actually dates back to 2010 in Florida. The NRA's most influential lobbyist, Marion Hammer, is based there and has been based there for a number of decades. And while Rick Scott was governor, she shepherded created a bill that became known as Docs versus Glocks that eventually that year was passed into law, which stated that doctors were not permitted, or it was illegal for doctors to ask patients whether or not they kept firearms in their home. Recently, within the last couple of years, after much back and forth and litigation, federal court found that law to be unconstitutional because it's a clear violation of the First Amendment. But it was a really acrimonious six or seven years that, you know, between the start of that law and the end of it. And there were a lot of accusations that were unfounded accusations that were made by the NRA, you know, and I could summarize that by saying that the accusations were that doctors across America were engaging in some kind of like larger gun grabbing conspiracy, and that's why they were asking their patients, as opposed to the more logical reason, which is that doctors ask their patients all kinds of questions, you know, whether or not they recreationally do drugs, whether or not they drink, so they can provide better health care. And that was, you know, that's what was going on there. And of course, this is sort of a continuation. So that feud came, you know, that feud eventually came to an end, and then the new study came out, and now it's erupted all over again.
Talking to Mike Spees, he covers the gun lobby for The Trace, looking at a rift this weekend and going back further between gun rights advocates and the medical community. And Mike, can you talk about doctors and trying to treat gun violence as a public health approach? The CDC, there have been questions about whether federal research can fund gun or federal funding can support gun violence research. What is the current state of affairs with the CDC?
They can't. They're not allowed to research gun violence. It's an ongoing. I mean, I guess I'm also summarizing that, but that's essentially the case. And that's something that the NRA has been fighting against for a number of years too. Somehow, the concern is that the CDC has some kind of larger cultural bias against guns, as opposed to what the issue really is, which is there is an epidemic of gun violence in the United States that takes the lives of some 33,000 people every single year. And if you saw it in terms of sheer numbers, that, as I said, rises to epidemic proportions and is no different than any other disease that takes the lives of thousands of people every single year. And their argument, of course, is that's how it should be studied. I think the NRA's primary concern is that once it becomes looked at scientifically, their argument, which is abstract and not scientific, becomes much weaker, since the, you know, doctors in general are not considered to be political. They're considered to be, you know, they're considered to be guardians and people who save your life. That makes sense.
We just, of course, went through an election. What did you see when it came to political activism on either side of the gun debate in our midterm elections?
I mean, for the first time ever, even if you know it was accumulated, gun violence prevention groups outspent the National Rifle Association. I mean, the National Rifle Association spent less than it has. Its total expenditures were roughly in the ballpark of what they were in 2010, which is a dramatic, dramatic decrease, especially back from 2016 when it spent some over $50 million, $30 million of which went to Trump. This year was, I think, around $11 million, which is a reflection of the NRA's current financial situation, which is not very good. They've been caught up in a really complicated lawsuit over a program that ran afoul of a number of state regulations that they had a lot staking. They had a lot riding on in terms of revenue, and that program is called CarryGuard. was a self-defense insurance product, meaning, you know, you buy insurance in the event that you shoot someone and claim self-defense, and the product purported to cover your legal costs. So that, coupled with the huge expenditures in the 2016 election and some other stuff that I think hasn't panned out, has put the NRA in a fairly precarious financial situation, and ultimately, I think, made it less of a force in 2018.
And on the other side, the gun control movement, has it seen a growth in support and, I guess, a financial and political clout?
It certainly seems that way. I mean, there's not, you know, I couldn't empirically tell you, but, you know, for the first time, certainly you had, excuse me, you had Republican candidates returning NRA money, and you had Democrats openly campaigning on the issue, as opposed to just it's something, as opposed to it being just part of their platform, but not something that they were making the, you know, primary or core aspect of their platform. And I think, you know, that has to do with a number of things, but the past year has been a really difficult one, and beginning with Parkland, sort of cliche to say at this point, but it did shift the political conversation, even if there hasn't been, you know, a legislative response federally, which is a whole other matter. I think it's fair to say that things are different now.
Talking to Mike Spies right now. He covers gun lobbying for The Trace. He's with us to talk about a recent back and forth between the NRA and a medical journal, and then healthcare providers, talking about gun control, a backlash from physicians after the NRA told doctors to stay in their lane when it came to gun control. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you follow this back and forth over the weekend? Should doctors have a voice when it comes to gun policy debates? Should we think of gun violence as a public health issue? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the NRA, gun control, and doctors who are sharing their stories of treating gun wounds after the pro-gun organization told physicians to, quote, stay in their lane, end quote, when it comes to talking about firearms. Our guest is Mike Spies. He covers the gun lobby for The Trace. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should look at gun violence as a public health issue? Are you interested in hearing from doctors and medical organizations when it comes to gun issues and gun policy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Green Bay. Mike, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, good evening. So I was appalled to learn that we cannot even at a national congressional level study guns and gun violence. I believe that the NRA is nothing more than a political lobby that's interested in maintaining their own power rather than truly helping the individual of America. And I say this as a gun owner and a advocate of gun safety. I enjoy hunting as much as anyone else does in Wisconsin, but that doesn't mean that we can't advocate for common sense gun laws and allow people who interact with gun violence every day in their life, like doctors, to share their opinions and help educate the public.
Mike, thanks for the call. Mike Spies, is that something we're hearing more of nowadays? Again, as you said, after the most recent mass shootings, even gun owners calling on the NRA to allow more research and things like that.
I mean, I think one thing, if it's, you know, it's I still don't want to make too much of it at this point, but, you know, going back to Parkland, in the wake of Parkland, you had some 64 or over 60 A or A-plus rated Republican legislators, state legislators in Florida, pass a gun bill that place new restrictions on firearms, including raising the age for buying a long gun from 18 to 21, among two other things. They weren't the most devastating restrictions in the world, or the most dramatic restrictions or changes that, you know, others have called for, which include assault weapon bans, that sort of thing. But still, if you can look at Florida as a bellwether state, which has been sort of at the vanguard of expansive gun legislation over the last few decades, it was a truly unprecedented, cataclysmic moment. I mean, they violated, willfully violated the NRA's authority. And then to top it off, Rick Scott, who had so eagerly done the NRA's bidding over his two terms as governor of Florida in every single way, signed the bill, which was also a huge moment, because the consequence of that for him, and maybe it never made a difference anyway, which is something that's worth exploring, is that the NRA shockingly spent no money on his behalf during this election cycle when he was running for U.S. Senate. Now he's obviously locked in a recount. But it is, it does suggest that it's possible when people, even the most stalwart defenders, not of gun rights, because I think it's an unfair way to frame it, but just the folks who are unwilling to even imagine a scenario, previously were unwilling to imagine a scenario in which, you know, there's some common ground in which you can have your guns, but also agree to certain kinds of regulation. When people are intimately touched by the issue and the country is watching, and there's a huge call for some kind of action, it is really politically difficult to not do anything. It's more complicated on the national level because, you know, it's one thing when it's focused in one state. Obviously, you're now talking about people that are spread all over the country, and just passing anything at the federal level presents its own complications. But there is definitely a shift. I mean, I think it is fair to say that the NRA has ceded some ground in the last year.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Tom with us in Madison. Tom, hello.
Hi, I just wanted to point out that this one statistic that you mentioned was misleading in that you say 33,000 people a year are killed in gun violence in America, but 23,000 of those are actually suicides. And so that number's bandied about. My position, I guess, is just that if we focused more on mental health issues in this country, and also, a lot of the criminal violence that occurs in the inner cities in America, if that were taken out of the equation, most of America is on par with the...
Oop, I think Tom just dropped out mid-sentence there. Oh, there he is. Mike, thanks for calling in. Tom, Mike?
I didn't actually say gun violence was the result of, caused 33,000 deaths every year. I said there were 33,000 gun deaths. I don't think that that's a misleading number. I think that's just a factual number. Guns, and I'm not saying this as an advocate, I'm saying it just as a journalist, guns are a far more expeditious way to kill yourself than by, a different means. But that's in some ways beside the point. I think the idea that you could somehow cut out, somehow like removing urban gun violence from the equation puts this country on par with other country is an odd way to think about it, because it suggests that the policies that currently exist, which put so many guns in circulation, are not connected to each other, which is a strange scenario. It's also strange to think about how, and this is the case in Florida, but it's in case of virtually every state, that those urban centers that the caller was talking about are totally handcuffed when it comes to trying to find their own solutions to such problems, because most states, almost all of them, have some kind of preemption regulation that prevents local municipalities from setting any of their own regulations stricter than those that are passed at the state level.
Tom.
There are so many ways to get guns right now. It's an unfair way to think about it and characterize it. If you're a rural gun owner or a suburban gun owner because you're not connected to crime, then your thought is that we should not have any restrictions on weapons, or we should be permitted to buy as many of them as we want. As if that didn't somehow drive demand or cause more weapons to wind up in the street elsewhere. That's just not. If that's the way you're thinking about it, then I can quickly clear that up for you and say that that's very, very misguided.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We'll go next to Michael in Arlington. Michael, hi.
Hi. So I would like to comment on the physicians asking the question about guns in the home. And my knee-jerk reaction to that was that it was totally unnecessary and they should not be doing that. But after considering it further, when you think about the fact that these physicians are often prescribing psychotropic medications to people, or, you know, any type of medication that they're not totally sure how the individual will react to, I think, upon that thought, I think it's their duty to ask if there are guns in the home so they can be aware of the fact of the danger they might be putting someone into. And then that goes right along with the idea that 23,000 of these deaths by guns are suicides, because how much does medication weigh into that? And should we at least be taking numbers on that with the physician? I think so. And that's all I have.
Michael, thanks for the call. I know there was the long court case you talked about in Florida. Mike, is it getting to be more state of the art for physicians to ask their patients if they have firearms in their home?
You know, I'm not sure. I think what the caller said, he made a very wise and smart point. I think that that's true. I mean, I think that I believe that to be among the reasons doctors might ask their patients about whether or not they own weapons. This is also a second, you know, there's another matter, which is often, I mean, physicians, you know, pediatricians are asking their patients, which are children, which is the same, I guess, you know, it's the same sort of, I guess it's thematically the same kind of idea, you know, whether it be because they have to think about what medications are being prescribed, but also some of this comes down to philosophically, what do you think about a doctor's role in a society? And the doctor's job is, in theory, to keep you as healthy as possible, and in some ways to protect you from disease or from harm to some extent, you know. And if there's the concern about psychotropic drugs, which is, you know, a wise thing. There's also the concern about if a kid's a teenager, for example, and the kid is experimenting with recreational drugs, or the kid's drinking, right? Teenagers drink. And your doctor is certainly within his or her rights to ask if you're someone who drinks when you're a teenager. And then to follow that question up by saying, is there a gun in your home and is it locked up? I mean, that's a acting as if those two things might not go together is potentially negligent.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Mike Spees. He covers the National Rifle Association and Gun Lobby, more generally, I should say, for The Trace. He joined us today to talk about doctors challenging the NRA over gun violence after the NRA told doctors to stay, in effect, out of the conversation. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, NPR legal correspondent Nina Totenberg joins the show for a look at the career and legacy of former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. She sadly recently announced that she would be withdrawing from public life after being diagnosed with dementia. We'll hear about the difference she made on the court and our legal system. Election results are still coming down in Florida and Georgia. We'll find out the latest in our weekly review of national politics. And Google Maps and travel apps make tourism easier and more convenient, but our guest says they take a lot of the fun out of travel. We'll find out how to recapture the joy of exploration. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 7:15, join John Munson and his guests for a look at same-day voter registration in Wisconsin and around the country, how it affects voter turnout, and why many states don't allow it. That's tomorrow at 7:15 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll have the latest on the viral photo showing male students from Baraboo High School giving an apparent Nazi salute and hear about how the community is reacting to that. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.